today's study is John chapter 11, verse 30. Let us read through verse 34. Sister Gail.
Now Jesus was not yet come into the town, but was in that place where Martha met him. The Jews then which were with her in the house and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she rose up hastily and went out, followed her, saying, She goeth unto the grave to weep there. Then Mary was come where Jesus was, and saw him. She fell down at his feet, saying unto him, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping which came with her, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled, and said, Where have ye laid him? They said unto him, Lord, come and see.
Verse 30. Now Jesus was not yet come into the town, but was in that place where Martha met him. In other words, it's saying what, in addition to this, that he remained at the spot where Martha, in other words, he was in transit. Martha comes to him and addresses him and has this conversation that we previously had studied. But instead of continuing on, Jesus, because she met him and interrupted him in his journey, she meets him and then runs back to Mary. But in the meantime, Jesus, instead of continuing to walk, stayed in that spot, stationary, until she came back. So it's a minuscule point, but nevertheless, it mentions it. It mentions this as though it might be significant. So, any questions?
Well, it would seem there's wisdom in this, because it dispensed with the preliminary conversation both Martha and Mary got the thoughts in their heart out, so that when he got actually to their home, he could go directly to the tomb to see the business at hand.
Any other comment? In verse 31, the Jews then which were in the house and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she rose up hastily and went out, followed her, saying, She goeth unto the grave to weep there. In other words, the Jews did not hear what?
What Martha said to Mary.
All right. This was like more or less in an undertone. Mm-hmm. Martha, like, whispered to him, The master wants to see you. But they don't hear that, and they see her get up quickly and assumed that she went up, she was intending to hurry to the tomb, and they thought, well, we'll go there too. So now, verse 32. Yes?
Can we assume that from a couple of things that are said, one is that the Jews had come to their house, and the idea that Martha spoke to Mary secretly about that the master wanted her, that these Jews were not believers, that the people that were there mourning were had not been followers of Jesus at all. Because it just seems a little unusual why Martha would say secretly to Mary, unless she did it because she didn't want anybody to be offended.
Well, we had discussed this, I thought, the last time.
I'm sorry, weren't here.
Oh, you weren't? The master asked to see Mary. He did not ask to see a congregation. And that she was explicitly obeying Jesus' instruction. and there would be psychological factors there too. Then we also discussed about who the Jews were. That the Jews, it does not pinpoint as to whether some of them might have been believers, some of them might not have been believers, but the suggestion was made, I think it sounds reasonable, that these are the local neighbors who were familiar with that family. That Lazarus was a well-known personality. There seems to be the implication that he's not just another person, but he's a person of some repute. And when they heard of what had happened, that it attracted quite a bit of attention. For unbelieving Jews to come doesn't make sense in itself, that they're coming with that attitude. These are sympathizers. They're sympathizers. They hear the news. They come. They're not coming to find fault because no miracle has yet been performed. So I would say it's a mixed company. But the people that knew him were there, those that was convenient to get there. And evidently there was quite a few in sympathy with the mourning on that occasion. We're not talking about Jairus' daughter or some of the other cases, which is a slightly different situation. And so they follow her, and now verse 32, it says that Mary, then when Mary was come where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying unto him, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. Any comments on this? Yes?
The exact same words Mark had used, so obviously they had discussed this matter together.
Yes, it might very well have been that. That before Jesus came at all, and Lazarus, say, had died. Now, this is like 4 years, 4 years, 4 days earlier. They probably had discussed it, oh, if the master had only been here. So it would be back in the recesses of their mind and comes forth at this emotional moment of confrontation. 33, when Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping, which came with her, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled and said, where have ye laid him? Notice it first mentions that he saw Mary weeping. And of course there was a close rapport between Jesus and Mary, who was accustomed to sit at Jesus' feet to learn of him. So he sees her weeping, and that begins to stir him emotionally, Jesus. But then it says he sees the Jews weeping, so it would seem to suggest that that there was some sincerity in this weeping, because it's her weeping and their weeping that now builds up a crescendo and within him that now he later will weep, but we haven't come to that yet, have we? It says, where have ye laid him? So you can see, as he's saying these words, that he's very emotionally stirred within. And now, some find fault with the Gospel of John, because they feel that when he uses this expression, the Jews, that many, many Jews, not just the Orthodox Jews, the conservative Jews, and so forth, they feel that the Gospel of John is sort of anti-Semitic by using this expression. But there is no indication whatever here is. He's talking about the Jews are the residents in the area of Judea and Jerusalem. That those people that reside in that area are styled Jews, where those who resided around Galilee were called Galileans. Not meaning that they were not Jews. I would say the rebuttal to that type of reasoning, and this has affected some in the truth even. I know of one particular outstanding circumstance where they got the wrong seed taught, and on that seed taught, it led to this party going out of the truth. Because they followed that consistently through and then reviewed John's gospel from that standpoint. But actually, you have to balance it out. It's telling that the Jews in that area who knew Lazarus and heard about what had happened, they're the ones that come. And that's what he's using the designation here. And even when he uses it in other places. But it is not necessarily meaning the unbelieving Jews. It can mean the unbelieving Jews in some cases, depending on context where it's used. But it's the people down in that area that is fundamentally what's referred to. We digressed here momentarily because of this experience that we heard of years ago and we're familiar with.
Brother Frank?
Yes. Right.
The idea here of Jesus weeping because of the suffering that Rotherham says, instead of that he was troubled, he was agonized. Obviously he wasn't agonized for Lazarus because he was, not only did he know that in the kingdom he'd be resurrected, he knew that in a few hours or a few minutes or whatever he was going to be resurrected, but for the pain that the family and those that loved him were going through, and he agonized for loving them. But I was thinking about how that scripture that says that we sorrow not as one who has no hope or those who have no hope. And the idea that when someone dies that we love, it's not that we don't sorrow, and it seems the same thing here. We know that person's going to be resurrected in the kingdom, so our sorrow isn't for that person, but for the family and the situation. And it seems it fits right in with why Jesus was sorrowing here.
Yes. Any other comments?
On the verse in the 12:27, it said, "Now my soul troubled." It's the same expression in the verse 33. He groaned in the spirit and was troubled. That was right after Mary has said, "Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died." I was wondering, besides, not as well as the emotional agreement and the compassion, he wept also. I don't think maybe more deeper, something like, this is going to be a proof of his messiahship. The death he may be facing a few days, a little while later. These people have said, if Jesus was here, my brother would have been dead. But then Jesus himself would have to die. And what they would think, I was wondering, that he was concerned. I was wondering he was concerned about that point.
Yeah,
I'm not sure about that.
Well, you're thinking quite an advanced thought there, and it could very well be, as you say,
your brother Franklin, another one,
that his farsightedness and perspective of the future and his own experience and how they later, his disciples, would mourn when he would die. And in that interim period when he's in the grave, there would be this anguish of spirit on behalf of his disciples that he could see. If these mourned for Lazarus like this, what would the disciples do in mourning for Jesus being crucified on the cross?
Another one in verse 37 said, could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind have caused the even this man should not have died? Mm-hmm. Which means, and then he said again, therefore again groaning. Mm-hmm. So that is a doubly second time again because of their, he could have saved those conditions. But then eventually he had to himself that how he could explain to these people about the situation and then to prove Messiahship.
Mm-hmm. They would have to await this later consolation. Nevertheless, sometimes the anguish is essential for the greater blessing. Just like the widow, the person who, in the parable, who made a request, we call it the importunate widow, that this delayed response to prayer or to action is sometimes needed as the seedbed of creating a greater blessing than had it to be done too precipitously, answered too quickly. The delay is essential, but there's anguish with it. Nevertheless, there's anguish with regard to it. Notice in the verse, any other comment before we call attention to another thing in verse 34? Jesus says, where have ye laid him? And they said, come and see, come and see. What interests me, this is almost though you can be there. Mm-hmm. Notice the intimacy of expression here. We are being transported back like 2,000 years earlier, and we're being given a very touching revealment of this incident in Jesus' ministry. Then it says, the next verse, that where have ye laid him? They said, come and see, and he wept. So he's weeping. Not that he wept one sob, period. But he was weeping. There's a little continuity there. Jesus wept. And now they're walking towards the tomb. Because they say, come and see, and he's weeping, and he's following along, and we can more or less see this, which is very unusual. Another thing that strikes me, too, if Jesus wept in connection with this incident, in spite of the fact that he knew he was going to raise Lazarus, so there's no problem there. He knew that these women, both of them, Mary and Martha, would be just overwhelmed with joy when he restored Lazarus. He did not coldly calculate that they're going to get, it's only a matter of a little few minutes, as it were, before they're going to be reassured, blessed, and comforted. No, he entered into it, the circumstance, now, in spite of what he was just about to do. Apparently, this is what was in Jesus' makeup when he was viewing the human race going down into degradation and sin and death and sorrow. That such a personality, viewing this, what's happening in earth. Now, we're talking about the pre-existence of Christ, his pre-existence. That now we can see that when the Father chose the Son to be man's ransom, that he couldn't have chosen like anybody else better. This, his very makeup is of this, that he's in such sympathy, so that when he would proffer the opportunity to Jesus to come down here, and to die on man's behalf, he knew that he would accept, not merely accept with resignation, but accept with joy, as though this is an opportunity, that he's only too happy to come down here. He's not weighing all the factors that he thinks of later as he meets them. But so this response of Jesus weeping, he wept when he saw the suffering down here, and not coldly detached like a surgeon in connection with what's happening. Yes.
He entered into the sorrow of the others. He knew that the heartbreak that death in Britain had brought.
Now we read verse 36 through 40. Next, please.
Then said the Jews, "Behold how he loved him." And some of them said, "Could not this man, which opened the eyes of the blind, have caused that even this man should not have died?" Jesus therefore again, groaning in himself, commenced to the grave. It was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. Jesus said, "Take ye away the stone." Martha, the sister of him that was dead, said unto him, "Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he hath been dead for 4 days. Jesus said unto her, "Said I not unto thee, that if thou would have believed, thou should see the glory of God?"
All right. Now, verse 36. When Jesus wept, then verse 36 says, the Jews said, "Behold how he," that is Jesus, "loved him," Lazarus. "Behold how Jesus loved Lazarus." Showing then that the weeping was not just a restrained weeping, but evidently it was an emotional outburst for him to say how he loved him. See, if he just, he loved him. No, it's how he loved him. So it was, it shows that this shortest verse in the Bible, "Jesus wept," is very significant, not in many ways, and you can see the effect that it had on those that witnessed it. But you'll notice that in the next verse, "And some of them said, could not this man, which opened the eyes of the blind, have caused that even this man should not have died?" It's very much like these women. "If thou hadst been here, he would not have died." So here others now are taking up the refrain, the same principle that Mary and Martha did. But you'll notice there's something else involved there. Any observation or comment?
Just that verse that you read? Is that what you
just said? What I just said just this minute, like what they said. Could not this man, which opened the eyes of the blind, so forth. Yes.
Okay.
All right. You have a comment?
I'm just going to say, that Jairus' daughter, has that been done before, previous? I can't remember the sequential order, but they knew that he had already done some of it.
Yeah, well, the only thing is that it says this is the Jews said. I would think that in connection with Jairus' daughter up there, that that was sort of somewhat a semi-private thing. It was those up there who were familiar with Peter and that household that... that was Peter's mother-in-law, I think. But no, this Jairus' daughter is another. That they could have heard. That's more public. Jairus' daughter being raised. There was an introduction to that. A lot different than Peter's mother-in-law being sick. That's more private. All right. They could have heard that, yes.
Perhaps because he was weeping himself, they thought he couldn't do anything about it.
That's the point. That's exactly the point. They misconstrued the motivation of his weeping. They misread it. All right, Sister Dawn.
I was just going to say that whether they were believers or not, it was obvious that they had seen or heard of some of Jesus' miracles. And two chapters back is an account of a blind man being healed. I don't remember where, what the area was. Well, it was the Pool of Siloam, so it wasn't too far away. So it could have been in the talks and connections with the neighbors who talked about how he was blind and it was, you know, he wasn't confident in his sight. So I don't know if, you know, like maybe word got around a little bit from that.
Yes, that's something like Sister Esther said. Yes.
I'm just thinking, though, is this should not have died, almost like, more of like if he had been there. So the question is more, should not have died. And if in this case, what they're thinking, that he could have healed even without being present, which he had done in other cases. Oh, thy way, thy daughter is well.
Well, there certainly were a few instances of that. This is near the end of Jesus' ministry. So the other things that Jesus had done are a backlog of miracles that had taken place, amongst which are some of these. Over here, anybody? Yes, he could have done the same thing. Now, notice with Mary and Martha, before their remarks, that if thou hadst been here, that's one. We've considered that. But there's also another way to consider that. As a gentle rebuke of Jesus, that had you come earlier, because you notice, the messenger got to him and informed him that Lazarus was sick, not dead. And he delayed coming back. Where our reaction would be, we'd run back. In getting that news, we would like run back, normally speaking. That's what you would expect of somebody else. It's like a doctor. You call for a doctor. And if he has another patient and all, we'd make more allowance. But if he dilly-dallied and didn't, respond right away, we would feel that there's been some little negligence there. So while they did say, if thou hadst been here, it may have been that they were a little disappointed that he had not reacted as fast. But he did it deliberately. Now we can see that there was a reason why Jesus did delay coming back. And being that he raised Jairus' daughter, she had just died. She had fever or something, but it wasn't as though she was in the tomb 4 days. In fact, he goes to the couch and awakens her. And the one on the bier who was being transported, woman's son, when he put his hand on the bier, as it were, and said, son, arise, that even that was as though the body is still warm, because the burial is performed the same day. The Jews buried their dead before sunset. So this is almost like the body is still yet warm, as it were, when he did these miracles. So all this has been taken into consideration. But to go that step further, that's another matter. This was like a hopeless situation. When they said, here Lazarus is not just died. He's been dead 4 days, and he's in the tomb, and the tomb is sealed, and the door locked, as it were. And that's like beyond all question now. Now we get the thinking of the public, and Jesus walking now, weeping, and going to the grave. And they do not see the real power that Jesus had at that time. And that verse 38, as attention has been called to where Jesus groans again, that second groaning was due to their misunderstanding of his first groaning. And that made him, like, be further agitated with it. Now it says that it was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. And Jesus said, "Take ye away the stone." Yes.
It's interesting in the remark that Jerusalem makes that the man who could do all these miracles need not have had anyone else take the stone away. That could all have been done too, but whatever one can do for themselves, it's expected that we do it. Not all everything is going to be put before them. They have to, they can move the stone.
Yes.
It was not necessary.
No, it's where man, where it's beyond man's capability, that's where Jesus steps in, as it were, and God. Remember Peter, when he was shackled to two men, one on either side of him. The shackles miraculously dropped off. That was a miracle. But then the angel says, "Now put your shoes on," and so forth. Peter could do himself. Then when he walked and followed the angel. When he came to the gate which had previously been barred, opened before them. That's another miracle. So it's there are certain things we're expected to do, and then there's other things that it is not expected we can do. We're not capable of doing, and that's where the Lord steps in. Now, when it says there was a cave and a stone lay upon it, normally when we read that, we think, well, it has to be then a hole in the ground and a stone on top. But no, a cave can also be horizontal. Or rather vertical, that is the mouth of an opening or cave. And the stone being upon it does not mean it has to be flat on the ground. It's laid upon the face of that opening or cave. So sometimes in taking it literally here, it, as it's in English, we can get a wrong impression too. And Jesus said, "Take ye away the stone." Now put yourself there with their thinking. And then he says, "Take ye away the stone." They say, "Well, what's the reason for that?" And another thing, we don't want to go in there with that stink. You know, it's not that he's dead 4 days, but who wants to go in there? If you go in there several months later, there's no odor. Bacterium and so forth, and microbes and so forth have taken over, then there's not that problem. But to go in now, that's the last one. And if anybody has smelled death, if you get that in your lungs, it's very difficult to get it out. And I remember one party told me at a occasion that was, I think I was lunching with him in the cafeteria, and he told that he was present at the exhuming of a body, that they wanted, I guess, to have a medical exam of the corpse. Maybe in this case it was because to see if it was foul play or not. And he said that when they opened that grave, and like the casket, that odor, he says, he could not get rid of. It just stayed with him. And that's the thing that he would dread, you know, that. So I thought, well, you know, you don't think of those things normally. So now when you're saying, "Behold, he stinketh," and then to open that door, you would say, well, what in the reason, what to what avail is that? Well, what's the reason for this?
Right.
Yeah.
Since we've been there, and you think that's the proper place?
I think so, yes.
Would you
All right, we'll do that as we go along. Now, it says Martha, verse 39, the sister of him that was dead, said unto him, Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he hath been dead 4 days. Now, Jesus says to her, hear his gentle rebuke. They had gently chided him. Now he sort of gently chides them. Said I not unto thee that if thou wouldest believe, thou shouldest see the glory of God? Well, they'd have to admit to that. He did say that. Now, notice, she does not reply. That silences her. Now you can mention there's a tense moment here. Now he reminds her, didn't I say, what's he going to do? So now it's more like mystery attached to this. And then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. And now we want to read these verses. Verse 41, the last half particularly, through 43.
And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me, and I knew that thou hearest me always. But because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. And when he thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth.
All right. Now, verse 41, Jesus lifted up his eyes and then made this statement, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. And I knew that, or you can say I know that thou hearest me always. But because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. I think the aorist tense is involved here, and the English does not quite convey the thought. I would say probably a bit more like this. I know that thou hearest me always. But because of the people which stand by, I say it. But this aorist tense, it depends on whether it's active, passive, and so forth, that gives it, it has an additional thought that our verbs and so forth don't have in the English. I think this conveys a little different thought. Because it's too matter-of-factly. You give it a present tense application here. Then it makes more sense. They're listening to him say these things. And he says, because I said it, doesn't make sense, but when he says, I say it, now they're listening. Yes, now they're alerted. Any comments on this?
That what he's telling the Father, and here, according to the Trinity doctrine, how can they ever reconcile these words? Why would he have to ask his Father in heaven if he's right down here on earth? I mean, just doesn't make sense, does it?
All right, well, the rest of the text, and then
I'm not sure if I get the correct thought, but as I was reading it, I thought like the end of verse 41 was something that he would say loudly so that those assembled around would hear, and then like verse 42 would be like him talking as it were to himself. To the Father, but verbalizing it, but not in a very loud public manner.
Mm-hmm. It could be that. I'm not inclined to think that, even now. But it certainly is another option, an alternate view, which is quite reasonable. Someone else wants Sister Chai.
He thanked before Lazarus arrived, he may be alive again. He thanked God first, and he heard. And he shows his belief, the belief of God, the Father will do it, and as if already fulfilled, he prayed for it. And also he prayed, God says, saying that he knew God would do it, but then he had to say, ask him, knowing, so that people hear that God will doing it. God is the one who doing it, even though he performed the miracle. So that Jesus is the Son of God.
Yes, we noticed that earlier too in John, a few other instances in the earlier chapters, that where he, before he would answer a question or so, he would give God the credit for whatever would be done or said. But then later he would speak with such authority. This is an earlier verse, earlier chapter. He would then speak about his importance, but not until first he involved with these statements of positive action, he would show the source of that power. Now, when he says, I am the resurrection and the life, one might get a wrong impression had he gone right ahead and raised Lazarus without this prayer. You would not see or appreciate the primacy of the Father as much as the way he did it here. And so we see that in these other proof texts of the Trinitarian, supposed proof texts, when we look at those proof texts and read a verse earlier or a verse later, it throws a completely different slant on it. That it isn't saying what they assume it says, he's bringing in the Father's supremacy. Even in those other instances, and so here he's doing the same thing. So it would then be completely proper to do exactly what he did. In fact, it would be improper not to do what he did here without making this acknowledgement. So, and it would be very effective. And I think by saying it aloud, it is educating the ones who are listening. It is helping them along that when he's explaining this, that he's helping, taking them by the hand to see into a deeper truth than they might not have perceived had he just gone ahead and raised them without this explanation at hand. Yes?
And he always gives credit to the Father, that thou hearest me always, and to the effect that others should know, it was not his own strength he was doing it, it was only through the Heavenly Father that it was accomplished.
Yes. Any other comment on verse 42? All right, now we go to verse 43. And when he had thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. So there is this introduction, and now it says he cried with a loud voice. Does that suggest something? Normally we think of a loud voice as a voice of authority, right? It's a command, loud. But it also suggests, and this is where we bring in about Lazarus' tomb. When you go over to see Lazarus' tomb, you walk up an incline, and on the left as you go up that incline is a doorway. Have it over the sign over at Lazarus' tomb. And personally, I think it's authentic for different reasons, but that isn't our investigation today. Now, when you go in there, you go in just a short way, like a vestibule, and then there's a stairwell. And you go down this circular stairwell, which is quite prolific in Israel. Whenever you go down, whether it's a well or they put the stairway on the side. So you go down this stairwell, And it circles down a fair distance, like a couple flights, as it were, down to a level, and it leaves you out into a very, very short floor level, and then there is a chamber, like a room, and it's in that room that the body would be laid. Now, imagine if you were dead. You're down there, and you have all these wrappings on you. Head, hand, head and the foot. And you're in there and with this clothing in, and you're dead. And Jesus is up above, fair distance, and you have, it isn't open. So it's sort of torturous climb there. And then he says, Lazarus, come forth! Well, you'd have to shout, as it were, for him to hear down there with all this bandage around his head and lying down in the chamber below. And the ones who would be listening would realize that the body's down there. They're familiar with the tomb. They know, for instance, when Lazarus was brought down there, don't you think there were many that may have assisted in transporting the body and let that be laid there, not somebody just put it over his shoulder like a sack of potatoes and going down. So they, the ones who are listening, know that that body is down a considerable distance, and now they see the reason that, why, does he think he's going to hear him? When he makes this statement, Lazarus, come forth, they could see psychologically that if you were alive down there, you'd have to shout in order to be heard. But that a dead man, 4 days to hear, that's another matter. And now they know that it would take time for him to come up. There's no elevator. This man is wrapped in sepulcher clothing. So he has to come with this material. He has to ascend this stairway with this material. So he has to feel his way up. Now they're on the outside and they know the circumstance of the tomb. And they know there's a long time in coming and they're waiting. And they know that if he ever awoke, it would take a little time. So they're all waiting with the anxious, bated breath. No, that's impossible. And they're waiting and waiting, and then maybe 15, 20 seconds, 30 seconds later. That's a long time when you're waiting. And then he appears at the tomb mouth, and he's there all wrapped up. They'd be scared to death at first. They'd think, wow, what is this? They can't believe it. And then they order him in their shock. They are forgetting certain other things. Well, he has to be assisted. Take the wrapping off. They take the bandage off his head so he can breathe more properly, and then unwrap the clothing so that now he's not under restraints and so forth, and so that he can walk more comfortably. And you can imagine that which was shock and fear now becomes, they'd be probably dancing around and running down the streets. A miracle's been performed, and they'd be running down the different, going back home to tell the wife, the husband, the children, or something, or the neighbors what had happened. Why, Lazarus is alive. We saw it. We could see that would create, in that little town of Bethany, would be a real uproar in that. And already there were quite a few to witness it, so they could say, oh, no, you're believing. Yeah, that's. There were plenty of witnesses. And then they're testifying this. This was some terrific testimony. And this is like the climax of his ministry as far as the public is concerned. One of the most outstanding things that Jesus had done for his whole ministry. Any other comments or observations? Yes?
Just that since John chose the wording very carefully back in John 5:28-29, when he said the hour was coming. In the grave to hear the voice of the Son of Man and come forth. And he keeps it rather exactly. Here's the sample now.
this is the basis for the other observation in the fifth chapter. So then when he says, I am the resurrection and the life, now that I mentioned it today, but now, see a deeper significance in that statement and a long way off fulfillment. That Jesus, if he has this power in connection with doing what he did to Lazarus, well, in other ways, we have like a living Savior who is able to do unto the uttermost those that would come to him, as it were.
Okay.
Yes?
Having climbed those stairs in that tomb, to think of Lazarus trying to manipulate now with the grave clothes in hand, he may even have had assistance from the angels to help get up those steps because his legs were bent too well. Those steps were hard enough to climb even in normal circumstances.
Another thing this helps us to see about our Lord's own burial. And it said that he was buried according to the custom. And the clothing that was wrapped around Jesus was like a cocoon, like in Egypt, where both legs are strapped together and become immobile. And you're like in a box, the way they wrap you up as a mummy. But the Hebrew style is where they take the bandage and wrap it around the leg, each leg separately. It goes into the other leg, goes around the torso, goes up around the neck, and then you put a napkin on your face, and that's wrapped around. And so it's like one continuous bandage. Of course, there may be breaks in the bandage, but it would be in its application, just like you put around a broken wrist or something, it would be, in principle, one continuous cloth, relatively narrow cloth, so that the hands were free, separate, and not immobilized against the body. Now we can see that when John looked into the tomb and saw the body lay, and he believed that Jesus was raised, he could see that the body was extracted miraculously from those bandages and collapsed without being unwrapped. Would be a proof of resurrection. And it gives us, it's as though John is very, very astute and alert. It's almost like an artist, that no little detail is wanting. And this perceptiveness of John in his gospel is everywhere apparent. When he's giving incidents, he brings in things that the ordinary person wouldn't even pay any attention to would be over their head because they're intent on something at hand and not noticing these little meaningful details. And thus it has helped us in the gospel account to get a greater appreciation as though you're right there and seeing it. Yes.
So the head would have been wrapped right across the face, correct? So that Lazarus couldn't have seen. It would have been dark to Lazarus trying to see.
We would feel, I said, he felt his way up there, but it's a precarious stairwell, and there would be no railing and things like that. He would be guided, and it's as though he heard that voice and knew the direction and where, whether up above or where that, and is attracted to the source of that voice, even though it just said, Lazarus, come forth, like a magnet coming up to that voice where it emanates.
Imagine the shock just waking up because you didn't know you died.
Yeah.
Down there in the hole. I mean, he'd know he was wrapped. The atmosphere, he recognized he was really him. He was dead. He had been dead anyway.
But the wonderful thing of that is, too, is that many Christians probably, if they allowed themselves to be enter into this narrative fully and sympathetically, when they would die, they would be hoping to hear that voice of the Master in resurrection glory. And that's what we would hope. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Enter thou into the joys of the kingdom. And so in principle, it's beautiful, but John's gospel, and it's complementary to the others, which they call synoptic gospel. But I think this is a synoptic gospel, too, of John. I think why they separated. But John's is more international in its appeal. It crosses all racial, religious, geographical lines, as it were, in its appeal. And thus, John's gospel has been very useful in probably in converting people, perhaps more than the other gospels. But Matthew, we wouldn't want to miss that for anything, and the others, because it's all needed.
Yes. When Jesus cured the disease, normally the virtue went out from him.
Yes.
In this case, if the biggest miracle caused more virtue to come out?
It probably did. But it does not say that here. But if that was a principle, it certainly would be exhausted because of that as the greatest miracle, and also because of his emotional expenditure that he made prior, when it says he wept. So it's not just the raising of him, but there was he experienced the trauma himself, as it were. But in the meantime, they wouldn't be paying any attention to that. They would have been seeing the miracle. They'd almost forget the master for a while. They'd be thinking of what has happened. We have witnessed something that's just unbelievable. So they'd be running around And now we can see that when he came into the city in his day of triumph, like we call it, but the Lord's triumphal entry, a lot of that acclamation would be probably induced by what this miracle that had happened here, so that when he would come in, that they would acclaim him in this fashion.
Yes.
This
idea of the loud voice and in connection with resurrection, it seems a little bit similar to 1 Thessalonians 4:16, verse 16, where we had talked about in the previous study, with the idea of the shout and the voice of the archangel and the dead in Christ.
That fits in with the other study we had.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very good. Voice of an archangel with the trump of God. So it would be now Jesus coming in humility later into the city. If you were there and had witnessed that, let me tell you, you take your coat off and lay it down at his feet to go by, or put it on the animal and that he might be very comfortable in his coming to the city. And the people laying reeds down and things like that. Why, this is a pent-up emotion that this man really, now they're beginning to think this really is the Messiah from what he just did. And gives quite a bit of coloring to this aspect of the latter part of our Lord's ministry. I think, we have to go a little, first let's read 44, through 46. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. Jesus saith unto them, Loose him, and let him go. Then many of the Jews which came to Mary, and had seen the things which Jesus did, believed on him. But some of them went their ways to the Pharisees and told them what things Jesus had done. Mm-hmm.
Yes. In verse 44, wouldn't it kind of indicate that when Lazarus did come forth, that they're almost like stunned and this motion was almost like statues for a moment. And then Jesus says to Lazarus, well, loose him, let him go.
Yeah. Yeah, we had mentioned that before. They were in shock. And then he forgetting the need at hand, that he needed to breathe more freely, and other that he was strictured by this clothing. Jesus possessed tremendous composure of mind, in mind. Mind very very organized, even if it went in his emotional trauma, and weeping. Nevertheless, it did not influence. You know what happens with any unusual emotion. It blinds your eyes, and your rationale. Speaking of a person being blind with fury, meaning when you're very mad, you cannot rationalize or reason as clearly. It does affect your thing. And that's true with joy as well as anger or sorrow. Can you rationalize or reason with a person who's in the deepest of sorrow? No, you have to repeat and repeat, and it doesn't sink in because the experience at hand is overwhelming, but not with Jesus. So when we look at all these accounts of his encounters with men, that to maintain the presence of mind of what to do, what to say, how to say it, and take in also that it's unbelievable. It's like a super mind. To be able to have this experience. Yeah.
When he was on the cross, John, the mother, yes.
Presence of mind under all circumstances. So, and that is suffering in that case. Then many of the Jews which came to Mary and had seen the things which Jesus did, believed on him. But some of them went their ways to the Pharisees and told them what things Jesus had done. Now this is the part that's puzzling, that you would say, those that would behold this miracle and enter into it, how they would believe. Not only believe that he did it, but that they would believe into him in the sense of becoming his disciples. That you can see that there would be many conversions, true conversions at this time. But that it says, and some of them, now showing that this is definitely a minority, many believe, but some of them, they go and tell the Pharisees. Now you would say that this is like impossible, but you know people are different. What you think there's no excuse for or nothing, other people know. And that's the true with what we saw with regard to the miracles at the time of the Exodus that took place, and in the wilderness wanderings, the great miracles that were shown there. People who witnessed those things could forget the next day. That's how fragile man is, and it shows that how one can succumb to evil and reap a destiny of destruction if they're not careful in pursuing the proper path. Yes.
Don't you think that was deliberate, though, that some of them, they had that spirit of envy or knowing that the Pharisees
On prestige, yes, sure. They'd be, you can see that the motive of them going was wrong. They're not going to say, now, you must believe now that he's the Messiah. Look what he did. So, no, the import here is that they wanted the Pharisees to be aware of what had happened in preparation of how to handle him. You know, to give them this inside information, as it were, as quick as possible, to their own advantage. And you say, well, that's impossible. It doesn't make sense. And so, but we find that in looking over Scripture, there are a lot of things, that miracles that are performed, that people, if they have the bent of heart, if they have had the practice of affinity with sin and evil thinking and so forth, that to break that chain, it means that you have to do something about it. You have to incline your heart towards reformation and being brought back to the Lord. So you have to call on the Lord, implore him for help, because a pervert in seeing miracles, it will not necessarily change them. You think it would, but no, that isn't the case.
If it were to, then the everyday living would be a homeless part, a homeless remnant would be the end. So it's only obvious reaction on a certain part.
I think, yes.
Brother Frank, why do you suppose this, which is like the most pronounced of the miracles,
what's the first part? What you say?
Why do you suppose that this, which seems to be the most pronounced of the miracles, is omitted from the other gospels?
Well, there could be some other reasons. For instance, when they were on this journey, he did send two of them into the city. I don't know. I really don't know. Yes. I have to think about it a minute. Yes?
Maybe it's just a testing faith on the ones who are reading the gospel, where this is specifically said. And if we say, well, it isn't said here and it isn't said there, that we may not, and we might have a measure of disbelief. But because of our recognition of all of
It comes to me now, but yes.
Well, I was thinking of what you had said about the motivation behind the writing of the Gospels,
right.
And this one particularly seems to be more directed toward those who would be willing to really get their hearts to the more universal duality directed just to the Jews and just to the Romans.
If you're writing a treatise about the Master, a lot has to do with that treatise, which is the Gospel, which records the instance of his life. The whole account is like structured in your mind as to how you're going to treat the subject. And you can get lost in that subject or that frame because you're pursuing what you're doing to a destination. Now, with regard to Matthew, and thus he was concerned with quoting the Old Testament prophecies as having their fulfillment, many of them, in Jesus' ministry. So Matthew, in writing his gospel, is working it out from that particular standpoint. And he also had another motivation with regard to the sinner aspect, that Jesus can reclaim the sinner, no matter what their background, the way he wrote. And each one had their own peculiar slant in doing this. Mark, it was for the Romans, to appeal to the Romans. And Luke's account is from a physician standpoint, which is an interesting thing, but that's not our prerogative at this late in the study to go into that. But he viewed things. And John was very observant of details that were seemingly not related to the incident at hand, but yet are startlingly relevant. Remember, he mentioned about the boat being immediately at shore. Here they're in the middle of the ocean, struggling away, and then the others are appreciative of that miracle, but they didn't observe, like he did, that immediately when he steps in the boat is at shore. They're overwhelmed with the experience without, narrating it. So a lot has to do when you write anything or think or give a talk or something. Usually you have a particular objective in mind and you're structuring everything. That is, if you're logically minded, you're structuring everything to that particular climax or purpose being fulfilled. And you do overlook certain things, I can see from that standpoint. This is a great miracle which could be overlooked, yes.
along that same line, it seems as though this account sort of ends abruptly, because you might expect John to record the interaction between Jesus and Lazarus and Martha and Mary, because a lot of time is spent with that earlier, but it seems like everybody was just so dumbfounded that when later on, when it's penned, John doesn't even like perhaps remember what transpired in terms of conversation afterwards.
Yeah.
And he just kind of sums it up and says that many of the Jews believed, you know, and that was all he could say after that.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, too, it's good that John recorded it because of his powers of observation. If he had piecemeal accounts in three Gospels, he had with some others, it might detract from the real power of his absolutely startling, beautiful justice.
And he gets personalized experiences, such as the Samaritan woman, Nicodemus, this account of Lazarus. I mean, there's something personalized, personally experienced. Yes?
Going one step further, you see, first, now they're in the house mourning all the people. Now they probably all go home and have a big dinner celebration. Rejoice.
Yes. And then Jesus says that this would be done to the glory of God. So how appropriate that he lifted his eyes to heaven and said, Father, I thank thee.
And this, I think, if I'm not mistaken, everything he did was to direct the disciples, what they must remember, I guess, in their ministry, that they did not. I thought I read it, that it's from God that all these two wonderful things have been done.
Yes. Why callest thou be good? There is one good. The Father. I think that giving the credit to its proper source. Yet he could speak very powerfully on his own behalf, but always with proper respect to the supreme deity. Yes.
It amazes me how they can say that he's God when all of these things.
Well, because the God of this world hath blinded the minds of men, lest they see the glorious light of the gospel in the face of Jesus Christ. And it's the power of Satan is just overwhelming of how he can blind. And we have the veil taken away, and we're rationalized, and we think, well, how can they blind? Which is true. I mean, you know, I feel that way. Why can't you see? makes so much sense. But actually, this veil that the adversary is allowed, if we are not like providentially led of the Lord, we would be in the same thing. We would be blinded. And we would be just as obstinate and sure of our blindness that we might be the blind leading the blind, even teaching them. Which seems to be a paradox. The blind leading the blind. I mean, there's a really... there's something pathetic about that. I think we should stop the lesson at this place and, Lord willing, on another occasion, start with verse 47.